All right. Good evening, everybody. I'm here with Jacob Williamson, who is a candidate in for State House in District 40, I believe.
Yep.
I was great to talk with you tonight. Glad to have him on. Jacob, how are you, man?
Doing good. How are you doing tonight?
I'm not bad. You're what, 20, 21?
21, yes.
What makes a 20-year-old want to jump into a race for the State House of Representatives? I mean, most of y'all are going to clubs and parties and stuff like that. What's got you want to go to spend your time in Montgomery?
Well, I've always been really interested in politics, and coming from a pretty small community, I care a whole lot about that community. And I could just go to Tuscaloosa and just, I go to Alabama, go to the University of Alabama, and I could just stay down there and do what you just described, what most students do, but it seems like a major waste of time. And really what motivated me to run is a feeling that I can actually do some good for my community and for my constituents. And I honestly think that a young person, a 21-year-old, has more reason than most to want to be involved politically, because if you look at what's happening now, the consequences of the political decisions that we're making now are going to be felt the hardest by people my age, because we're going to be the ones that are trying to buy homes or trying to build families or careers in the economy and in the system that we're working on now. So, that's sort of what motivated me to run. Another thing was just timing. It wasn't necessarily that I said I'm going to run right now. The incumbent representative is retiring, and he's done an excellent job representing us, and I felt like it was, felt like everything had just lined up right.
So you mentioned buying homes and buying the economy back, 20, 30 years ago. Birmingham was called the Pittsburgh South. We had all the things necessary to make sleep. You drive through Birmingham now, it's a ghost town with things that are shut down. What kind of jobs would you be looking to try to create for this upcoming economy?
Well, statewide, we can see a whole lot of industrial jobs sort of coming back. I mean, and we're starting to see it now because we have, compared to so many other states, a pretty friendly business climate, particularly in hiring employees. I mean, we're one of the few states that has no minimum wage, state, mandated minimum wage. And, it's not that all these businesses are coming here and paying ridiculously low wages, but they recognize that this is a state they're not going to get taxed to death if they do move their operations here, like Smucker's and, this is just to name a few recent ones. But what really, what I think we have the most opportunity for in my district are those sorts of blue collar and skilled jobs like that, the manufacturing and things of that nature. And, especially in Cleburne County, it's a very rural county, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for development in that county, and that would bring new opportunity. So especially in Calhoun County, my district covers Jacksonville State University, the very commercial areas of Oxford, and those two places are really the economic powerhouses of Calhoun County, or Jack State and Oxford. So I think that we really just kind of need to take what they're doing and expand it.
Is the Anniston Army Depot and Fort McClellan, that's in that district too, right?
That is not in the district. It stops right before it hits Fort McClellan. The district stops on Highway 21. Actually, I think it might stop a little bit while back now they redistricted, but it did stop right before Fort McClellan. I think they may have pulled it even closer back to Jacksonville now. But a lot of people that worked out there do work in the Anniston Army Depot, they do live in the district. A lot of them are still very affected by what goes on there.
So you've got a lot of retired military that probably living up there in that area.
Yes, a whole lot of retired military.
Okay, so you walk in there on day one. What's the first bill Jacob's going to introduce?
If there were one thing that I feel like we should be looking at as a state, it is really time for, it's probably going to be the grocery tax. And a lot of people don't realize we are one of three states in the country that still apply sales tax to foods being bought to be prepared at home, for groceries that you're going to take home and cook. Not fast food. That most states still apply sales tax to that. But, if you go out and you buy fresh produce or fresh meat, most places aren't going to apply sales tax. Alabama is one of three states that do. And you know, at a time when our state government is taking in record revenue and pulling in record amounts of money, it really seems like now is the appropriate time to finally get rid of that. It's an unnecessary burden, and you know, I think that's something that everyone can agree on, especially considering our state passed the gas tax and now gas prices have, you know, gone through the roof. I think it'd be, and a lot of grocery is increasing in price. I think it'd be a good sort of relief to a lot of people.
You're the first person I've heard mention that. I didn't realize it was only three states that tax food and medicine, but I knew we weren't many. I think that'd be an excellent idea that would help, you know, everybody a lot. Yeah, I'm sure you've been following politics for a while. It sounds like it. You know, we got a Republican governor, Republican legislature. How come they can't seem to get anything done down there?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. And, you know, it depends on your perspective, really, what you're going to say. Most people would, some people say they get a lot done. And a lot gets talked about and a lot of things get done, but they're not the kind of things that people really expect to get done. And a lot of times they aren't really communicated. You know, we're still trying to get constitutional carry in the state. Things that seem like no-brainer issues, legislative issues, for a Republican state like Alabama with a Republican trifecta, you know, it should be pretty easy to pass, are often a lot harder to pass than you'd think. And one reason is I think you have a lot of people that get elected, and, you know, fortunately in Cowan County, we had pretty good representation in terms of people that showed up and did their jobs. We had, you know, Cale Brown, who I'm running for his seat, did an excellent job. Obviously, Del Marsh was Senate pro tem and did a whole lot of work in the state government. But, you know, they have no staff. They have no, you know, they're not required to have a legal background necessarily in terms of, you know, being familiar with writing legislation. So a lot of it's really just left up to them. And because of this, you see the majority of legislation being written by a small group of legislatures are producing the majority of legislation. And, you know, as a solution, I would say we just elect people that are dedicated to actually writing and passing legislation. But, you know, a couple other issues are that it's very difficult once you get elected to sort of balance all the different interest groups. It can be a challenge sometimes. If you're someone who got elected and is sort of relying on the support of various groups throughout the state, you know, there's plenty of lobbyists down there. There's and they're all willing to come in and tell you what you're doing wrong and what you don't need to vote for and why you should not vote for this. And, you know, I think a lot of them just, they don't want to step on toes, you know. So
one thing that I noticed, and I'm not sure why, it seems like our legislature, they get caught up in too many hot button issues and still don't get it passed. Like you mentioned, constitutional carry. I think it was last year they got locked down for 2 months on transgender kids not playing sports, which I figured that would pass in 30 seconds. Instead, we're spending 2 months on that, and we got way many other things we worried about. Do you have an opinion on why they get so locked down on that? I know that's kind of a tough question and more of opinion, but it just seems like they just get locked up on this, so they're arguing for 2 months.
Well, the process is not, to be fair, it isn't meant to be entirely efficient. I mean, it is not what anyone wants to hear. But, you know, to a certain degree, the tension and the conflict that arises when they pass legislation is sort of to make sure that no legislation that we aren't certain we want passes. Now, I think that that has too big of an effect oftentimes in that, you know, like you said, legislation that we all are in basic agreement over ends up being a central point of contention. And it ends up stalling any other work on other pieces of legislation and addressing other issues. But, you know, I think that it's really one of those things that, if you're not there, it's probably not something you can diagnose. It is probably not an issue that's easy to diagnose if you haven't been in the room, because there's so many things that can cause it. I mean, you got to think it's 140 people down there in total, and the 35 in the Senate, and, you know, you've got 105 in the state house. So, and then you've got a number of Democrats, but, you know, even getting 55 people to sit together and agree on something, it can certainly be a challenge, especially when, you know, 20 of those people can have one group calling them and telling them to vote against it because of these reasons or to amend it for these reasons. And, you know, we see a lot of that going on. So a good example is the lottery bill. You know, in the state Senate, it was not the Democrats that stopped the lottery legislation. It was the Republicans. The Democrats also voted against it at the last minute, guaranteeing that it was going to fail for their own ridiculous reasons. But, you know, there were just a certain number of Republicans, and they had said their constituents reached out to them. And it's not that they were against the lottery. They were attaching the lottery to gaming, which to me just seems like something we should separate because it'll be easier to actually legislate and pass. And, you know, those six senators had heard enough from their constituents that they weren't going to pass the bill. You know, they it's safer to do nothing a lot of times than it is to do something and people get mad. So the incentive is usually on just, you know, not doing something.
Smarter, though, because, I mean, I like the first time, the only time the bill ever came up to vote in the state was in 99, I believe. I voted against it. And the reason I voted against it was because Governor Sigmund promised 85 or 95% was going to go to education and everybody's going to go to school and pre-K. And then I look at it and it's like a pyramid that's going down and everybody had their hand. One of the commercials was lottery, not this lottery. Well, I'm looking at every state around us has someone gambling. Our dollars are going there. I mean, let's just bite the bullet. I mean, people get mad. They'll get over it. I mean,
the last way they were, the last bill that they had proposed, the one that got voted down, which was, you know, really, Senator Dale Marsh, our state senator in Calhoun County, he had a pretty big role in it. And, you know, it was mainly going to fund broadband internet expansion and education were the two things. And I felt like that was the completely appropriate. Those were two very appropriate things to fund because, you know, the two things that I think everyone can agree on are some basic governing responsibilities of the state are probably increasing broadband internet access to keep us, you know, sort of competitive and, you know, keep our communities competitive and, you know, stay economically competitive. At this point, it's just basically a necessity for any business to want to set up somewhere is that you have decent internet access. And education is another essential area. You know, something that is also true about education, though, with the lottery at least, is that I don't think the lottery is the guaranteed fix to education. I think that it can help funding for it, but, you know, in the state of Alabama, we've just continued to sort of throw funding at education for a while now, and it hasn't improved yet. I think if we want to talk about education, we really have to talk more what we do in terms of, you know, not just dollars spent, how we actually change education, how we actually improve the education system. And it's worth mentioning also, just real quick, that, you know, the last education budget that was signed was the biggest in Alabama's history. And, you know, now Kay Ivey's got her pre to three program, which is focusing on education from pre-K to third grade, which, you know, we've got one of the best pre-K programs in the entire nation for many years. It's been ranked one of the greatest. But somewhere along the way, throughout high school, throughout elementary school, we're not sure where, things are going wrong. And those gains that are made, you know, it's not as effective as it is in pre-K. Our pre-K program is much more effective than our high school programs. So, you know, I think we really need to start looking at what we're doing in regards to education rather than just how much money we throw at it. So,
yeah, that's an interesting answer. Don't think I've ever thought about that. Because when you said it, my mind started clicking, but I remember, you know, every year hundreds of millions of dollars being thrown to it. And I think at one time we was actually ranked 25th in the amount of money that was spent on education in the country, and we're still ranked last. Have you thought about what the answer to that is? I mean, what's the problem?
So this is something that I would absolutely, you know, want to speak to more educators about and more people across the state, because, you know, this is speaking from my experience and what I see locally. One thing that I've noticed is you have a lot of people that just go to school to go to school. And in recent years, it's become increasingly easy to just show up and pass and then graduate with your diploma. You know, in the past you had registration or graduation exams. I'm sure that when you were in school, I don't know if they required graduation exams then, but you know, eventually they did away with those because you had people who couldn't pass the graduation exams. And I understand why people were opposed to graduation exams, but at the same time, you need some way to make sure that these people are not just going through and learning nothing, because otherwise we are wasting the money and we wouldn't expect it to get better. So something that I think would be an interesting solution, or something worth considering at least, is it's not necessarily bringing back graduation exams. I'm not proposing that, because I don't think that the only benefit of schooling is just learning the content you're being taught. I think that you should probably have a couple of different paths to travel down. And luckily, this is something really popular right now, is expanding trade school. I would say that we need to expand trade school and, you know, trade school opportunities. And, you know, in Calhoun County, we've got an excellent career tech program. People can go for the medical career tech pathway there, and they can actually, by the time they graduate, if they stick through it through, you know, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, then when they graduate, they can take the EMT exam and graduate a certified EMT. And that's, you know, a very marketable skill that they have. And then we've got a fire college program, or an early fire college program, basically for seniors. And, you know, that's something I think we should look at expanding to law enforcement. I think that would be a very, very, you know, have a lot of potential there for benefit. But, you know, basically, I believe that students should either be taking college preparatory courses or even college courses, because that's, you know, that's what I did. I'll be graduating with my undergrad, you know, in 3 years rather than four, because I took, you know, 22 hours of college credit in high school throughout the years, and it was incredibly beneficial to me. I think that's something that we should increase that. But people should be either taking college preparatory courses or getting college credit. They should be in trade school. JROTC is an excellent pathway to actually getting somewhere. Or if you don't want to do any of that, if you don't want to, you know, learn a trade, if you don't want to get ready for college, or if you don't want to, you know, get ready for the military, then I think maybe that would be everyone, whoever's left, whoever is doing none of those things. I don't think it's wrong to want to check and make sure that they've actually learned something from their high school experience. Since they don't want to actually try to develop a skill necessarily or focus on getting into college or preparing for college, I think that, you know, it's not wrong to say, well, okay, then if you're going to graduate, we're going to make sure you learn something. You're going to make sure you gain something from this experience. So, you know, that's one. I think that'd be one useful benefit.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that about trade school, because I don't hear people really push that anymore. And when that was put through, I mean, get a lot of opportunities. People, I had an interview with Chris Woods, ran for mayor of Birmingham, and he pushed that. Utilize that more, where when the students graduated, each of them, I think he said, learn two trades. And I thought, well, yeah, that's a brilliant idea, because if you have a trade, you're making a lot more money. You know, money and poverty go hand in hand. You're going to have more crime to spread. And that was, I thought that's a pretty good idea, because I've heard a friend of mine, he was arguing back and forth, and he said something about somebody being a plumber. And I said, well, I see more vital that, or electrician. I said, the electrician or the guy at Starbucks with a PhD in philosophy, communism. Because we're not putting enough emphasis on that. And there's a lot of jobs that people could have. Let's see. So we've talked about education. Something I've asked every one of these candidates for different offices. When is Alabama, we've already passed the medical marijuana. I mean, when are we going to step up and just legalize marijuana and tax it? I mean, there's a lot of money out there.
There's a lot of money, but I'll tell you this. I think that is something that for Alabama, we are not there yet. I don't think we're at the point where it would be responsible necessarily to legalize that for market sale at this moment. Because, you know, first off, the federal government has sort of failed in this endeavor because they've kept it, you know, illegal at the federal level. Now, they've said that states that legalize it, they won't enforce that policy or they won't sue the states. But, you know, just because they're not actually pursuing legal action against the states doesn't mean that there's no consequences. You know, the national banks, a lot of national banks won't work with businesses that are engaged in what at the federal level was a crime. So, you know, it's really hard to invest money, to get small business loans, to do anything like that. And what you see in some of these other states is, you know, a lot of these people, they think that it's legal now. I'm going to pursue a career as, you know, a professional marijuana, you know, salesman. And they try to open a business or they open a farm, and it ends up causing a lot of economic cost. It causes a lot of problems, because realistically, the society is not ready yet for it, in terms of, and not because they can't handle it, because the institutions aren't ready to handle it yet. It's not something we've entirely worked out there.
Until the federal government decriminalizes it, then it's infeasible for the states to totally legalize it and make money off. Is that
right? Yes. Yeah. Now, states can make money out of it. They can tax it, but again, it isn't that the states can't tax it. It's that it puts the people who get into that business in an unwinnable situation, basically. I think it'd be dangerous to do that at this time. Now, you know, we've got the Medical Marijuana Commission, or Medical Cannabinoid Commission right now, headed up by, what's his name? He was the former Treasury, McMillan, I think, yes. Maybe. Yeah, former Treasury Secretary. And he's, you know, I think that what they'll do is they'll look at that some more, and kind of, I'm sure that'll kind of continue to shape the conversation in the state. And another thing is, I also don't think it should be legalized without going up to the citizens first. Now, I think that if the legislature were willing to legalize it, then the citizens are most likely definitely at the point they would legalize it. But it's still one of those things that is such a, you know, it's an issue that affects people at such a kind of an individual level that I would just like to put it up to the Alabama voters, just to be sure. And, you know, just to be sure that they're supportive of it, you know, because again, go ahead.
Somebody brought up an interesting point about something like that to me the other day that I never thought about. And it probably wouldn't fly, but he's actually made a good point. He said he didn't want to see it go before the Alabama voters because we're not a democracy. We're a representative republic. So you sent your representative there, and if you didn't like it, you take it on that person. So, you know, and we have. I'm sorry, go ahead.
All right, go ahead.
So every constitutional amendment you think we should put before the voters? Because I'm looking at stuff down there sometimes from Pickens County, you know, tax from their hogs down there. I don't know what's going on down there with their hogs.
Yeah, I think that most local issues and issues like that, you know, they should go before the voters. I don't necessarily have a problem with that. But, you know, it's kind of like finding a balance. You know, yeah, we're a republic, and that's the point of having a legislature, is that you have people to actually go and make laws. And you kind of need a balance between, you know, letting the voters express their clear support or, you know, disapproval for a certain piece of legislation, and actually representing them as we do in a republic, you know, speaking for them. So are we there as voting delegates for the constituents, or are we there as sort of more trustees, like we're caretakers of the state and they've just trusted us to make our decisions? And like I said, it requires a balance of it. And on the issue you're talking about, the balance would be, I think that any attempts to legalize it should go before the Alabama voters. But when we have to create a regulatory system for it, that's going to have to be done in the legislature. Any sort of the regulatory system for, you know, what happens if it is legalized, or what happens, you know, if we were to legalize, if we were to expand medical marijuana, that's something that would have to be handled in the legislature, because we can't ask the citizens to vote on such particular, you know, issues. You know, how should this regulatory agency be structured? You know, that's not something we really leave up to them. But the bigger question, the larger question, which is, should this be a legal substance in the state? I think that's something that they can understand and they can handle pretty easily. The specifics of it are what would probably need to be left up to the legislature. So, and that's sort of my position on it.
It's a pretty good, interesting answer right there. This gas tax, how did they get away? I mean, nobody said anything to them about it. They just passed it, and I mean, How do they get away with that?
Because I'll tell you. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, as much money as they're bringing in, now they're going to raise it, you know, and raise taxes on there. I mean, I'm raising a lot of cane with my life.
Yeah, that was, I'll say it's something that was not supported by a lot of my constituents and a lot of people that are in my district, and a lot of them voiced those concerns. It was one of those things where if you're in the legislature, I suppose you had been hearing something that made it seem like a better idea. And look, I'll admit this. I'll admit that there are roads that needed to be repaired across the state. That I don't deny that. My question is HALDOT using the money in the most effective way? You know, I know a lot of people that are throughout the state and work, some of them work with HALDOT. But, you know, and a lot of those people understood why so many people were opposed to it, because, you know, really the way HALDOT funds projects, I mean, you know, some people don't necessarily feel like they're appropriating that in the best way. And another thing is, you know, most people in my district, they're at a pretty standard income. So their income isn't going to fluctuate depending on the year or with the market or with cost of living or anything like that. So when the gas tax goes up and they have to spend, you know, an extra 5, 8, 10 cents a gallon at the gas pump because of the state of Alabama, that is just more money they don't get to spend anywhere else. That's just more money out of their pocket. They're not going to get a cost of living increase in what they bring home because the gas tax has gone up. They're just going to get to bring home less of it. And that's really probably the biggest reason I was against the gas tax, is that, you know, it was not incredibly beneficial for people in my district. It was putting them in a worse financial situation. And besides, the timing hasn't been the best. I mean, I guess you could say it's been good and terrible, because on the one hand, they would never have gotten the gas tax passed after gas prices have increased like this. There's no chance that has enough support, even from legislatures, I believe, to pass if they were to try it at a time, if they were to go into next session trying something like that, because gas taxes are already so high. But on the other hand, you know, on top of the spikes we've already seen, we've got a gas tax there. You know, imagine what the gas prices would be a couple cents lower across the state if we hadn't passed the gas tax. Now, I'll also say in Calhoun County, we've had a lot of road work getting done. We've had a lot of roads repaired. It's been very frustrating as a commuter and as a traveler, but it is nice to have nice roads. So, you know, there are benefits and downsides to it. And that's really the decision you have to make, or that's really what you have to consider whenever you make any legislative decision. But, you know,
sure, sorry, it made me think of a funny story I got of our legislator. There was something where I forgot, there was going to be extra money to counties with so many people in it. Our county fell like 2,000 above the minimum threshold. We begged and pleaded begged the legislator, and they just ignored him and passed it. I was like, man, I would have shut that place down. I would have read the Bible from front to back. I would have filibustered every bill from there. I mean, they didn't help me on that. I would have shut the whole legislature. There, nothing would have got passed. And I'm still mad at him for saying. But that's just my personality, though. I mean, I would have. There's no way we would have gotten anything passed from, you know, the next 20 years unless they voted me out. The next question I had, I got talking sort of my mind was talking about the gas tax. I should even went into that. the state income tax level. I mean, we have the lowest in or still some of the lowest in the nation. Have you ever looked at how much we're bringing in on that? I mean, I was looking at some numbers the other night, just on our state figures, as you were talking about. And there's an unbelievable amount of money that nobody's accounted for. I mean, I've got stuff, $2 million here, $5 million here. I mean, why is nobody looking at where all this money's going to?
Well, you get a whole lot of, you know, funding gets spread out all over the state, and there's always people applying for grants or applying from some sort of aid. But there is one benefit to Alabama, to our, or one of the benefits to sort of how our legislature and our government is structured, is that we have a balanced budget amendment. The budget has to be balanced. We cannot run up a deficit. So, you know, there may be money missing that can't be accounted for. It's certainly not acceptable. However, I also think that that's something that the legislature is probably not adequately resourced to stop or to deeply interfere with. That's a state auditor's, that would probably be under the state auditor's purview.
Under the state finance director, the auditor, they have basically stripped the auditor of all their power. They audit like how many textbooks, how many school buses.
Not actual raw numbers. Okay.
Yeah, and when I called to find out about that, they said, well, there's different comptrollers. I said, so what, you just got 50 checkbooks out there and everybody's writing checks? I mean, because, you know, there was a lady the other day I was reading about, she stole $1 million of COVID money from there. There's money missed. I forgot what the number, the figures have suddenly disappeared, but there's so much money missing from the first round of COVID money. The money they was going to build for federal prisons is gone, and now they're taking this. And we still, I don't know if they spent it yet, but we had $800 million. They had not even spent yet.
Well, I'll say that one issue that has sort of shown its face since this whole coronavirus situation has been, you know, has started, is the amount of money that the federal government has just sort of thrown out. Is, you know, the situation you're describing where we have unaccountable money is much worse, I would imagine, at the federal level with the amount of spending that we've gone through. You know, I know that there was a small business in my hometown where I grew up that they had a number of issues where people were trying to claim unemployment because they were having the unemployment benefit bonus that went on way too long. And luckily, we were one of the first states to stop that. One of the first, but not the first. But we stopped that pretty early compared to a lot of states. But people were saying that they had worked there and that they had gotten fired or they had quit. And they were trying to get those unemployment benefits. And the store owner had to repeatedly, you know, contact the, you know, Department of Labor and let them know that, you know, these people have not worked here. They're trying to scam the system. And that's something that you see a lot of, and you see even more of it when there's just money everywhere. You see a lot more attempts at fraud. So, and that's...
I'm sorry, didn't make it catch up. They were giving people money through the payroll protection thing. I mean, I know somebody got $12,500 and not even work. And I'm like, you know, you're just throwing money. Well, they're not throwing money because, you know, people think that they're getting this money. All they do is create inflation because they don't make free money. Okay.
Yeah, all the other money just has less value when we throw out free money. Really, it's just you're devaluing the currency. So, and yeah, that's a total another a whole other problem right there that the federal government has caused, basically. You know, because, you know, and we see this in every legislature. You know, whether it's Congress or whether it's the state house and the state senate in Alabama, is people are very people can be very reactive in politics. They want to just get something done. And I think a lot of the coronavirus relief funding bills, even the packages, even the ones that were passed when Trump was in office, you know, in hindsight, it looks a lot more like, okay, maybe we could have done without the insane number of stimulus checks we received. You know, it seems like it's much more clear in hindsight that we overreacted.
Maybe gave money to, you know, more to British citizens than German citizens. I don't know if you've actually looked at the numbers now, but I've looked at it and just absolutely furious. They gave the 13 million or whatever to nonprofits, faith-based, and I think 350 million to UAB. And don't get me wrong, I know UAB helped a lot of people, but they're not hurting. But now we've got states or counties that fixate their hospitals because we're not funding Medicaid. What's the answer?
Well, one thing that we can do there is open up and really get more, expand rural healthcare access. That's basically the issue, is that if you're in a very rural area, you know, in Calhoun County, we're pretty fortunate to have Anniston RMC here, and then we've got There's Gadsden Regional Medical Center in Etowah County, just right up the way. But, you know, other than that, there's not that many large hospitals, just very accessible if you're out in Fruithurst or Edwardsville, which is very rural area, to say the least. So I think one sort of an easy short-term solution, at least, is to try and get more clinics in terms of just doctor's offices, more health clinics. Our aftercare clinics are very beneficial. Get more of those set up because, you know, people can go in there. They can at least get, you know, see a doctor for if there's an emergency or, you know, get some kind of help or assistance. And if need be, they can go to a larger facility. They can be, you know, driven by ambulance to an actual hospital to for treatment. But, you know, what I would say is, because it's never just easy to build more hospitals. That's certainly not a...
building more hospitals. I mean, we've got them that's fixing to close because we're not properly funding through the Medicaid system here. I mean, we're throwing money... like I said, I have no problem with UAB, but UAB's not hurting. You know, they're getting plenty of money. I wasn't even aware of this, and I don't even know how many people have seen this, but I guess they're retiring, but we're going to have a major problem with dentists in rural areas. That no dentist there. And I don't know if you've ever had a toothache, but, man, there's nothing worse than that.
Well, I'll tell you, I spoke to a guy, a gentleman from Dothan, I want to say, who was working on trying to open a dental school there, a dental program there. And, you know, Alabama, it shocked me, but not as much as it probably should. We are 52nd, I believe, in dental health, in oral health, in the nation. And, you know, it was shocking, but it's also like, okay, this is just another area that we could really use some improvement. And one of the reasons is, I believe that at that time we had the one dental program in the state. We had the one that he had come from, but there's not incredibly many opportunities there to really go into that area of medicine. And it's a pretty good one. And like I said, this is something that in Calhoun County we are fortunate again. And people don't realize Calhoun County is the 10th biggest county in the state. So a lot of these problems that these very rural counties face aren't really problems for Calhoun County, but, you know, other places, Cleburne County, these very rural areas in Cleburne County's in my district, that's something that we can improve there, is really helping get more of those opportunities, more private doctor's offices, more dentist offices, more, you know, just things like that. And one thing that'll really help bring people out there into those kinds of counties is because, you know, counties like that, they have similar issues typically. They're very rural. They're not necessarily developed commercially or anything in across the county. You know, maybe they have a few economic hubs, but it's not widespread. And, you know, often you see that they don't have widespread broadband internet access. And, you know, even cell phone service is something that in a lot of these places, you can't even get reliable cell phone service. And just being realistic, it's very hard to convince businesses, doctor's offices, dentists, people that are professionals to move out to these very rural counties and set up businesses or and establish a life there if they don't even have cell phone access when they walk outside. You know, that's we've got to create an environment where people want to move their business. You've got to create an environment that is open to economic development and open to, you know, people moving in or people staying in that community. Honestly, it's not even about people moving in. You just need to get the people that are graduating that community to not all leave and go somewhere else, you know, because if they're looking for economic opportunity, you know, a lot of these people, they're going to places like, you know, Huntsville, places like Birmingham, to even some degree Birmingham. Birmingham's nowhere near what it was, as you said, but the type of job in Birmingham has really shifted. There's a lot more sort of white collar jobs there. It's not the industrial machine that it once was.
52nd. I did not realize Alabama was ranked 52nd in dental care. I mean, that's, I mean, you know, yeah. Houston, we could say thank God for Mississippi and Arkansas, but we can't even say that. That
can't even be thankful for the territories with that. So
not the territories, but I've heard that. You know, when you said that about Birmingham, I think in 1970, there was Atlanta and Birmingham was about 350,000 people. Now Birmingham is below 200,000. It's now the second state. You know, the only thing there is keeping it up is UAB. We've lost, you know, some of the banking system, which we was the hub. But I know that's not your district. It's technical jobs, like in Huntsville. We'd be looking at expanding those more, trying to get, you know, there, because we got Boeing here.
And I think there's a lot of opportunity to expand those. You know, we've got several high quality universities in the state of Alabama. We've got a lot of resources that I don't know if they've been fully utilized yet. It doesn't really seem like it. You know, we've got UAB. I saw the other day it was listed as the 8th largest hospital in the nation. And for Alabama, for the state of Alabama to have the 8th largest hospital in the nation, that is an incredible, incredible, you know, benefit to our state. And most people don't even realize that. You know, we just kind of not going to say take it for granted, but it isn't appreciated. And I don't feel like it's fully, we aren't really using it to our benefit.
The top 25 hospitals in the world. People don't realize how great UAB is.
Well, and it's the same with, you know, Auburn is an excellent engineering school. It is an excellent agriculture school. Alabama has an excellent engineering program, and it, you know, also has an excellent law program, which really, I think that lawyers aren't providing the they're not really what I'm worried about with getting more of them to Alabama necessarily, where the state's not going to economically collapse because we run out of lawyers. But still, you know, we've got a lot of opportunities here. UAH, you know, they're getting a number of military contractors. I saw where some of the new hypersonic missile technology, there's a researcher in UAH who's going to be working with the military on some of the fuel injectors or fuel, some kind of new fuel or innovation there with hypersonic missile programs for, you know, the military. And those are resources that I think we can continue to utilize. And another thing that people don't realize that honestly won't be seen for a couple of years in Mobile, you know, a lot of the money that we're bringing in with the gas tax is being used to supplement the some federal money that was given to us to dredge the port at Mobile and make it a deeper water port. And, you know, when that's completed, that is going to bring in a significant number of job there. You know, we'll have a pretty good amount of people, you know, shipping things down through Mobile. And you know, especially right now, it's a great time too. It timed up right great because you look at what's going on in Long Beach or in California where, you know, they can't get these, I think they're called longshoremen, something of that nature, what they call the people that unload the docks. You know, the unions just run those states. And, you know, they're not allowed to work in 24-hour shifts or, you know, they're not allowed to keep going. They resist automation or anything like that. And Alabama is a state that's not going to do any of that. We're going to give businesses the opportunity to be as efficient as possible. And, you know, I think that in, you know, 10 years, we'll see the Port of Mobile is one of the most active in the nation. You know, I think it'll be a very central shipping hub. So, but, you know, again, like I'm saying, there's a wide variety of areas that Alabama can bring in professionals to work in these industries. There's a lot of industries that Alabama really does have a good business climate for, and we just need to spread that throughout the state. Really, we don't need it centralized in so many, just a select number of areas.
You know, Alabama, and I don't even know if there's a way to advance this further or capitalize on it. I'm sure somebody a lot smarter than me could think about it. But, you know, we're one of the top in fishing and game and hunting. And then we have the top golf courses in the state or in the United States. And that's what we utilize to try to build on that.
And, you know, it's funny that you should mention that, because that is something that I think it's the Hoover Institute recently released a report, and Condoleezza Rice helped on it, on Alabama and, you know, Alabama Innovation. I think that's what it is, the Alabama Innovation Committee, or the Committee on Innovation. But basically, they're looking at ways for Alabama to utilize its state resources, its natural resources in the future. And one thing it said is that, you know, we have the most biodiversity as a state out of any state. We are in many ways the Amazon of America. You know, the our river system is one of the greatest in the country. We have, like you said, some of the best fishing, some of the best hunting. I mean, it really is a beautiful state. And one thing the report recommended was increasing tourism sort of interest in people from the outside coming to Alabama to experience the outdoors. And that's something we could market a whole lot more. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with like Lake Guntersville, Guntersville State Park, for instance. It's a beautiful state park. And I'm sure there's a massive amount of people that enjoy going there. You know, we used to go all the time when I was young before tornado did some damage in 2011. But I remember the massive amount of people that used to go there and camp all the time. And that we have, you know, we have tons of resources and areas across the state that we could develop and use in that way. But we haven't yet. We haven't really been able to fully capitalize on those. I mean, yeah, in my district, we have Chiao State Park. And it's a beautiful state park. It's the largest mountain and the tallest point in Alabama. And, you know, if things like that, we really need to figure out how to sort of modernize that. You know, how we need to, part of it is really just getting the word out. It's just advertising to the world that we have all of this here. You just need to let people know that it's here. And another thing is, you know, like Jacksonville, Alabama, I represent them, and something that they're doing as a city, and it really, I'm a big supporter. It's a great initiative, and it's genius that they're doing it. Is they're taking old signs and they are remodeling them or redoing them, like the metal historical signs, and putting them up in old yards or like places that supposedly have some sort of, you know, like haunted past or something. Someone will say they saw a ghost there. Maybe it's just an urban legend or anything, but you know that they'll put up a sign there and say, you know, that this is a well-known area for this reason, basically to try and encourage people to ride around the area and look at what all it has to offer. And the idea is that, you know, eventually we may have like basically a digital map in across the state of locations like that. You know, if some, you know, with the internet, there's a lot of opportunity to broadcast our assets, and we haven't fully realized that yet. But I think we can. And I think a lot of, you know, like I said, what's going on in Jacksonville is a great initiative. And I think it's going to work out very well for them. And I'd like to see that sort of taken statewide. And I think that a great way to do it is basically a digital, you know, digital map.
Over here close to where I live, and you're just going down a country road. I mean, it's paved, thank God. But there's caverns in a cave over there. It's called Banger Cave, and supposedly Al Capone used to come there and
yeah, visit
the cave. I don't know anything about that. I mean, that's an excellent idea, but
yeah, exactly. There should be a, you know, a little metal sign up saying Banger Cave, supposedly the hiding place of Al Capone. People can go there. They can take pictures. You know, and people, when they go tour these places, they aren't just going to, most of them aren't just going to look at it. Most of them are going to go and they're going to stop by a restaurant or a gas station, or they're going to spend money in that community just by going through there. And, you know, it just shows that we have something to do. It just shows that there is something to do nearby. There's some kind of, you know, it's not nothing. There's no, you don't have to just sit at home and, you know, find, you know, stare at the woods. Like you can, there's interesting things out here. It's a great state. We just, I don't think we're marketing it the best that we should be.
Is it because of the people we continue to send to Montgomery?
I think some of it could be because I think some of the reason that maybe I think about things like this and people are starting to think about things like this is it shows sort of a generational difference. I don't mean to be cruel, but
I laughed. I said I was talking about something the other day and I said something about millennials and I said, oh my God, I was just turning into my father.
Well, you know, the truth is that younger people, I think, are very well aware of how, you know, especially if they're the sort of entrepreneurial minded, they understand how to market these things. And if you've lived like I've lived, and, you know, obviously I remember a time when I did not have internet or a cell phone or anything, but I'm on the brink of that. You know, basically anyone 4 or 5 years younger than me and on, they're not going to grow up in a time with the internet not being a very significant part of their lives. Unfortunately, that's just how it is now. You know, I mean, the social media, you know, the massive worldwide communication, things of that nature are commonplace. That's just part of the world now. And it's all happened very quickly. You know, the economy, the society overall, you know, it's all changing in terms of how we do business and how we communicate even. And it's changed very fast. And I don't think everyone is necessarily taking the time to react to it or to fully understand how it can be utilized in our favor. And I think that younger people, and I don't mean younger as in, and I'm young to the extreme, I think, in what I'm saying. I think younger people, even, you know, probably around your age, have a decent, or are starting to realize all of the opportunity that this affords us now. You know, what we can do that we weren't able to do before. So
you mentioned change, and I was talking to somebody earlier about how it seemed like I went to bed one night and I woke up and the whole world had changed. I mean, I got introduced to all these different terms like gender fluid, and then somebody told me I was a cis man, an insult, and I was like, "What does that mean? It says you identify the gender you was born with." I didn't need a term to tell me that.
Yeah, that's.
How far is this going to go? Is this going to be pushed down our throats? I don't even know what this stuff means anymore.
So I think that at the federal level, I don't think it's going to last much longer. I'm really thinking that 2022 is going to be quite the backlash for Democrats. I mean, we saw what happened in Virginia. And, I think a massive part of what was happening in Virginia is, well, you saw it. You saw Terry McAuliffe say at the debate, you know, parents shouldn't be deciding what's taught in the schools. And he was referencing not only critical race theory, but there was a story from the Loudoun County school system, which is, I think, it's in the top five biggest school systems in the country, where they had a student who identified as a woman. He was a boy. He was a male student. And he went into the bathroom and sexually assaulted a female student. And the school, covered it up. And they sent him to another school where he got into another incident. And when that broke, I mean, I think that woke a lot of people. It definitely woke the people there up to the fact that, okay, these people aren't necessarily looking out for your child's best interest. As terrible as it sounds, and I don't mean the teachers or the faculty, I mean the administrator, you know, these boards of education out there that basically act as if they just get to decide what your kid learns, how they go to school, what their school is structured like, without any consideration from the public, you know, that upset a lot of people. And the backlash to that was severe. I mean, you saw people that did not vote for Trump, that definitely voted for Joe Biden, switch to the Republican ticket and vote for Glenn Youngkin like that. You know, as soon as they realized that, okay, I'm losing control of the basic, you know, basic things like what my kid's going to be dealing with at school, you know, what kind of environment they're going to school in, that really shook a lot of them up. And I think 2022, there's going to be a massive backlash to it. But if there isn't, I at least can say confidently that at the state level in Alabama, and I hope, but I feel pretty confident that we will not be seeing any of this pushed down our throats, at least in law, at least in legislation or from a policy standpoint. Now, culturally, it's a whole other set of problems that we're going to have to deal with. But, you know, at the public policy level, I think that we're safe in Alabama. And we saw the backlash to the transgender athletes in the state, you know, or people trying to compete, you know, boys trying to compete against girls. And, you know, I don't think there was much division over that. I think we were pretty unified in how we all felt about it. And at least, like I said, from a public policy standpoint.
Well, yeah, I think you're right that I was culturally. Yeah, I don't on that too, because I didn't even know that it happened. Because I was talking to somebody today about that. I said, "You know, what's going to happen the first time somebody's sexually assaulted?" And I didn't. I guess set up pretty good. I'm surprised, you know, that there wasn't more heard about that.
I think the only. Sorry, go ahead.
And what I was saying, I was talking to somebody, a guy the other day, he's 24, 25, and I asked him because I just found out through a friend a trans woman was his girlfriend, and then I was like, then I had to figure it out. I was like, what? Yes, yeah, well, you know, that you're not straight, and you know, he was trying to make an argument. And then somebody told me, they said, well, if you're not a bigot, then you will understand. I'm like, no, this is not how this works, okay? I'm not a bad person. I'm not calling you ma'am. I'm not calling you sir.
Yeah, yeah. Well, words have meaning. And, you know, my policy is always that I have not yet ran across a transgender person that I know of that has asked me to change my word use because of them. But, you know, words have meanings. Now, I'm not going to be a jerk to someone. If someone's respectful to me, I'll be respectful to them. But, you know, in the political world, if I'm discussing with someone about whether a man can be a woman, then, you know, that's a completely different issue than just talking to someone in a polite way on the street. You know, if someone changes their name, like Bruce Jenner, he became Caitlyn, he was still a man. But he wants to be called Caitlyn now. I would call him Caitlyn. You want to change your name, you can change your name. I'm not going to go out of my way to be a jerk, but I'm also not going to change my word use to reflect your inner identity. We shouldn't change the entire, whole institutions in society because of how one person views themselves or what their idea of their true identity is. You know, people identify as lots of things. And another,
sorry, go ahead. But I've transformed. I mean, I consider myself a retired 65-year-old CEO, so, you know, I want a pension now.
Yeah. Well, there's, I mean, to a certain point, it's like there's no limit to it, you know, to the extremes that have their philosophy. And another thing, sorry, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, and sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off because I didn't really show. What I'm afraid of is what's going to happen next. Because I was already seeing this on YouTube. The next thing is you're going to have the doctor saying, what's normal for pedophilia? You know, this is just normal. And you're going to start seeing that push soon. I guarantee you.
Well, I have no doubt that there are people who are going to use this, you know, this new culture, at least amongst the left, of acceptance and everything to justify terrible things, because that's just what happens. And I have no doubt that just like whenever they start letting men use women's bathrooms, everyone said eventually something is going to happen, like you said, and something did happen. We know it happened because it happened in the Loudoun County school system, in the school system, which is the worst place for it to happen. Also, it's terrible that any student would have to go to school worrying about these things. And it'll be the same way, I believe, with what you're saying, with people who are pedophiles or, you know, sexual, I don't know, offenders, trying to say that it was a medical condition. It's a mental disorder. You know, something is wrong with my brain. I can't help it. Well, that doesn't really matter. That's sort of irrelevant to the question, you know. And it's just like people said with gay marriage, and it's a completely different issue, but people said, you know, eventually someone will be wanting to marry their dog or marry an animal or something of that nature. And, you know, I would be incredibly shocked if there has not been an attempt somewhere in the country during these very confusing times of someone saying that they are married to their animal, you know, like
I said the same thing. Somebody's going to come out and try to marry a dog or a cat and I still believe it's going to happen eventually too. You know, I wasn't surprised when the you know, because the debate has been going on for gay marriage since the 90s. You know, it started off wanting to be civil unions, and then I think Massachusetts was the first state to pass it statewide or something. But then, you know, I just knew it was all downhill. But it seems like that's when all this transgender stuff popped out too, and I know I probably just offended half the alphabet by saying that, but I mean, it seems like that's when all this stuff popped off and you started seeing it everywhere.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's that, I think the two are certainly related in that all of these big civil rights movements that we're seeing now, the, you know, and I don't mean the civil rights movement, the legitimate one where they wanted voting rights. I mean the and desegregation. I mean the new modern social rights movements, the social progressives. All of that, I think, really started in the 60s when you had, you know, women's studies became a very big area where, you know, all of a sudden we were discussing the patriarchy and feminism. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hit you up. What is women's studies?
Women's studies is it's basically like critical race theory, but for women, for gender. It basically looks at everything. It's a way in which you study the world from the perspective that there is a patriarchy that dominates society, and all of society is somehow serving the patriarchy or is structured in this way because it benefits the patriarchy. It basically, the like I said, the gender version of critical race theory, where all of society is white supremacist and everything is structured to support a white supremacist, you know, social structure. And both of them are just nonsense, realistically. The original women's rights movement and feminist movement was a very legitimate and noble cause of, you know, and it was women's suffrage. It was, you know, women want to be able to have basic rights that men do. And also, you know, it was very intertwined with temperance, the temperance movement, the idea that, you know, all these men shouldn't be drinking so much. They need to come home and be decent husbands. They don't need to stay out getting drunk constantly. And it just made such a wild swift where it went from, you know, our husbands need to come home and be quality husbands to women need to reject marriage because it's serving the patriarchy and it's an institution meant to trap women. You know, it just is completely insane. And, you know, that sort of probably was the first big one we started seeing become prominent in terms of being taught in the universities, because the universities also, I'll say, seems like, I don't want to point to where a lot of these problems began for our society. It was in the universities in about the 60s and 70s. But, you know, that's when you also saw critical race theory really starting to be developed. People like Drake Bell were doing a decent amount of writing. And then you also saw, intersectionality, which that came a little bit later. But, you know, that's really where we're at now. The intersectionality, you're probably not familiar with it, and you probably wouldn't like it too much. It's a legal theory, is at least how it started out, was a legal theory that someone can be a woman and they are victimized in society because they're a woman. Or they can be a African-American woman and they're victimized in a different way than a regular woman or than a white woman because they are African-American as well as a woman. Well, then you can take it even further and say that you are a trans woman and an African-American and you're victimized in three different ways. So it's basically like a victimization hierarchy, where the more victimized groups you belong to, the more, I guess, virtue you have in society, or the more disenfranchised you are. And you couple that with sort of this culture that incentivizes victimhood or rewards victimhood, being a victim, then, you know, basically we end up in a position now where being a victim in many ways in the culture is easy and beneficial if you're in if you're surrounded by progressives, if you're in a social circle that is a progressive sort of far left circle, then they look at all that as, you know, oh, well, if you're a homosexual African-American woman, then you are, you know, you're terribly victimized by the society. So we need to try to help you as much as possible. You're the one who really needs all the assistance. It was very, you know, it was a pretty terrible system. And that was also, it's kind of been the Democrats, you know, campaign strategy or political strategy moving past Obama. In 2012, they thought that they would never lose another election again. They thought that they could just combine all of the minority votes and all of the women votes and all of these different groups. And like I said, they thought that was going to just keep them together forever because, you know, the country is becoming a larger minority country. And they thought that would just guarantee electoral victory until the end of time. And they were wrong, as we've been proven. I mean, Trump made gains with every single demographic except for white men. So over from 2016 to 2020, and he scored the highest.
That was so odd that he lost. lost among white males in that group, and every other one he gained. I thought that was.
I mean, even the LGBT group, even that. there's actually like, I think there's like four or five more that I left out. It's just too many for me.
QI and there's something else, and you know, I usually finish off with LMNOP.
Yeah, just finish the alphabet. But even that group, Trump carried 28%.
Which I thought was very, which could really swing a race among black males, 18 to 33. He was polling like at 30%, and yes. You know, that was unheard of numbers.
Especially for a Republican. I mean, he did better than any other to be the such a vicious racist, you know, as they say. He, I'm joking, of course, but he carried a massive number compared to Romney, McCain, Bush. Yeah, I mean, any of them, any other Republican nominee. So.
He never was. He was the vicious racist. You know, he became president or started.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one of the especially kind of target, but you know, he's build the wall, and it's like, it's illegal. And I was like, you gotta understand, this is not about race or about keeping brown people out. It's about
illegal. It seems pretty simple that we would have some sort of structure at the border, especially if that border is seeing a whole lot of criminal activity come through it. Like, it really just seems like common sense, providing for the basic defense of the country. But
we,
you know,
go look at this, and I want to make sure I don't quote it wrong. The original thing that was all Trump about the border was, this was a bill that Bill Clinton signed, and then Obama built the cages. Some of the Democrats walk out. Bill Clinton today, I mean, I know you're putting more than they would be calling him a rhino. I mean,
He would be in that wing.
Yeah, he would be a rhino. They would be calling him a rhino Republican because he is nothing like what today's Democratic Party's with. And I don't know. A friend of mine, he's a retired professor in New York University, and he describes himself as a classic liberal. But he sounds more when you talk to him because he says he can't identify with the Democrats anymore.
A classic liberal is going to be, you know, if anything, I think most people, if they say they're classic liberal, you can almost accurately predict that they would describe themselves as a libertarian when it comes to politics, just because that's where I think a lot of people that are classically liberal fall. But, you know, the Democratic Party is not the party of openness or tolerance or anything like that they would preach. You know, really the best opportunity for, you know, getting in and making inroads into a new party politically is the Republican Party. I mean, the Republican Party is the ones that is electing record number of women for the Republican Party to Congress, and you know, having a lot of, you know, increases in minority communities. We had excellent results from in 2020 in the Miami-Dade area, where there is a massive number of Cuban immigrants. I mean, you know, frankly, the Republican Party looks like going forward, it could very possibly be the big tent party that everyone's going to. The Democratic Party, just they want people that sort of will just listen to what they're saying, listen to the woke demands coming down from the top. You know, they aren't interested in people who, they aren't interested in freedom of thought. You know, they don't tolerate.
Go ahead. So I've been saying for years that the greatest untapped voting resource out there that nobody can get out is 18 to 24 year olds.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to get 18 to 24 year olds out.
How's the Republican Party going to?
I said, how is Jacob going to get?
Oh, how am I going? Okay, sorry. Sorry, cut out for a second. Well, one thing that, you know, I have an advantage of is I am in that demographic. So, you know, a lot of those people, I sort of understand what their concerns are going forward. And that's why I keep emphasizing expanding broadband internet access to so many of these areas, because a lot of these people, especially if they're from rural areas, I mean, they know what it's like to grow up where cable doesn't run down your road. You know, I mean, that's for the first 12, 13 years of my life, you know, where I lived at, and it was incredibly rural. You know, I was out in Ohatchee, but you know, we could not get cable internet down our street. So we had no internet access. And if people are growing up like that, they understand how important that is to them in where they live later in life. So, you know, being able to recognize issues like that, and also like small cell technology, which is something that is not talked about enough. Small cell technology is basically, it can be put on power lines and we can run it, you know, down the power lines, and it'll expand cell phone access or cell phone service without the need for building entire towers. And a lot of rural areas could really benefit from that. Because, I mean, like I said, no one wants to live or move or, you know, buy a home where they have to stand in a certain spot in their house and hold their phone to the ceiling to get cell phone service. You know, people just, this is part of life nowadays.
Use Wi-Fi or I will not, or it'll drop.
Yeah.
I'm not that far. I'm 30 miles from Birmingham, but I've had, but my other friend, you know, he's got cell phone service and works fine, but yeah, I have to use Wi-Fi or the phone will drop. And
yeah,
you know, it's very frustrating. Of course, I mean, I can remember back before we never had them, and I don't know how I would live with, you know, Adam now. You know, I was like 16 or 17, and my parents, they had first one in the city up there living, you're talking years ago, and it was a, like what the old flip phone used to be, but it was huge. Well, I just thought I was cool and riding around on this thing and talking. Well, yeah. They had wrong charges back then, and they got hit like about $1,500.
Jeez. Wow.
That one got taken away from me. I think that's about all the questions I have for you, Jacob. Is there anything else that you would like to say? One last thing, one pitch to get the voters out to
get campaign. I think the only other thing we haven't really touched on is might be abortion.
That's right. That's abortion, yeah.
You know, and this is a pretty quick one. It's an easy answer for me. I'm pro-life. 100%. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, the youngest baby in the world by the Guinness World Records was born in UAB, just got declared because he lived long enough. And he was a twin that was born at 16 weeks, if I'm not mistaken, which is just insane. That the reason I mention that, though, is because as time goes on and medical technology improves, the argument for abortions becomes less and less defendable, in my opinion, because at a certain point, terminating a pregnancy really isn't incredibly necessary. A childbirth is the least dangerous now that it has ever been in all of history. It is easier now. It is less strenuous on the mother. We have more resources.
Cases or endangerment of the mother's life.
So the reason that I typically just say we're going to draw a straight line, endangerment of the mother's life is such a small proportion of incidents. And this is something that, you know, Ben Carson, he always mentioned. I remember that it was really interesting to me when he brought this up, because I used to, a few years ago, I was a bit more, you know, open to arguments like, you know, rape, incest, endangerment of the mother. But, you know, it's such a small proportion of occurrences that it's a danger to the mother's life, especially now with the medical technology we have, that it doesn't seem like we should be really shaping policy around that, especially when it comes to, you know, from my belief, I'm a Christian, and I do believe that it is a life, it is a living thing. So I think that making the decision to end the life of a baby is something that we should consider very, very carefully. I don't think that we should allow it simply because in some instances there could be danger to the mother's life. Now, again, those instances occur, but I don't think we should necessarily shape public policy around it. And with rape and incest, you know, this may sound cruel, but, you know, frankly, something wrong happening to you does not justify you murdering an innocent. I believe that the proper response to your rape in society would be having the rapist castrated or even killed if it's a continual issue with a certain individual. I think that we should just be much more aggressive with combating crimes like that or with handling crimes like that. You know, that's not one of those we can rehabilitate someone issues typically. I don't see that as I think that is a, you know, you are a threat to society and you should not be a part of society. So it's, I think that's sort of the answer to that. And again, with incest, you making bad choices, and I guess it could be an accident. I guess some confusing situation could occur where someone, I don't know. I guess there could be some incident.
But, I don't know who my sister is.
Yeah. Most people do. So, you know, I guess it's, you know, but I guess in, if we're just considering all scenarios that could happen, that still isn't to me, it isn't enough to justify the taking of a baby's life. And because I do consider it life and I consider abortion murder, I have to just draw that heavy line and say, I can't support it. And by the way, that's what the Texas abortion law, it banned all abortions. It did not make exceptions for rape or incest. So this isn't just, you know, people act like we have to have those exceptions. Like, okay, well, we need that. Well, no, we don't necessarily. I mean, there's a, you know, it's, if it's murder, it's a pretty simple argument to me. If it is murder, and I consider it murder, but if you consider it murder, then it doesn't seem like we should ever really allow it to be acceptable. Under the most extreme cases, maybe, but like I said, that's a case by case situation. And on the public policy level, I think that Alabama's values are pretty clearly aligned with, you know, respecting the rights of the fetus to personhood.
I mean, that's a pretty strong stance to take. I mean, not a lot of people would be would be that strong on it. You know, the incest thing, whenever I've asked people, I always say rape or endangerment of his life, because I've left that out, because, you know, if you're going to do that, then that's
your, yeah.
Endangerment of mother's life, I've often had a problem with, because then you're deciding, you know, you're
trading.
And the rape, you know, that, making somebody live with it, that, you know, it'd be hard, you know.
I don't want, to be fair, I don't want them to live with it. I think that adoption is fully possible. And, you know, I also think, just really quickly, I think there's a lot we can do to make adoption a more streamlined process in Alabama. Is nearly impossible to adopt at this point. And unless you have considerable time and resources available. And, you know, I understand there's a lot of it is to protect the well-being of the child. But at the same time, you know, when you have people that are qualified parents that have raised children to adulthood successfully, that have done well in their careers, that are professionals, that can pass background checks, that are upstanding members of the community, when, you know, and I've talked to some of these people personally, and when they say, you know, we were going to look into going into foster care, maybe even adopting children, but the amount of cost, the amount of time you have to have available and commit to it, you know, you have to go to a number of parenting classes, and you're not really, you know, I don't mean to disrespect the DHR or anything, but you're not necessarily treated the best either. They're incredibly harsh on you, and as they should be if you're not doing what you're supposed to. But most of these people are trying to help out, and they're trying to help a child. They're trying to take on extra responsibility to give a child more opportunities. And we should be finding ways to make that easier to do. We should be finding, you know, rather than more difficult, you know, because if we're going to be in a state that takes a strong stance on abortion, and it seems like the electorate does support, whether it's the hard line that I draw or it's a 6 week, you know, line, you know, when we can, there's a heartbeat or something of that nature. Regardless where the line is, if we're going to have that strong stance, then we need to improve adoption and streamline that whole system.
I've got the stance that I would have to draw is, I don't think somebody says it's 6 weeks. Yeah, you know, I don't think I want this kid. I'm going to go have it aborted. You know, that's where I guess I'm going to draw the hard line at. I don't like to see it used as birth control.
No, that's a very cynical argument that people make, is that, you know, it can lower population. Or I even heard one person, they said to me that, you know, crime rates dropped in a number of places after Roe versus Wade. And I said, that is a terrible argument. Are you saying we go into crime-ridden communities and take all the children? I mean, because that seems to be the logical extreme of what you're saying. You know, I don't think simply because crime dropped or poverty might have dropped somewhere, that does not justify what is essentially mass murder of fetuses in many ways. So,
and yeah, there's been no telling how many millions. I forgot what the count is now.
It's an inordinate number, especially considering America's population is at its lowest level of growth. And I'm pretty sure since around the Great Depression, I think we're at our lowest level. And while that may not seem like a big deal, it's an incredibly big deal whenever we get, if we aren't producing enough children to take care of the older generation and to keep the workforce full, whenever all of these people get out of the, whenever older people start retiring and leaving the workforce, if we don't have enough young people to replace those that are leaving the workforce, then we're going to end up with a worker shortage. The population decrease isn't even a good thing to begin with. If anything, we should be having more children to, keep the labor force full. But, it's a whole other issue. So,
well, man, I appreciate this time, Jacob. I don't want to keep you more time. I've had you on here for an hour and plus minutes. But there's cut tagging though. Thanks for coming on, man. I'll have this probably take me a couple hours to get it edited and posted. But as soon as I do, I'll shoot you a link to it.
Okay. I really appreciate it. And again, I really enjoyed talking to you. And it's been a good conversation. And anytime you want me to come back on, I can talk about these issues for a while. So,
well, I've told each person I've talked to is the race goes on. If they want to come back on and give a 3-minute ad, like a commercial or what, feel free to do it. Especially as as it gets closer to like one.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Hey, you have a nice night, Chris.
Good day. So,